celebration of the African Center for Biodiversity's, ACB's, 2-decade of activism, we welcome you to the launch of a legacy podcast series where we will take time to look back at the history of a key strand of our work, namely resistance against the encroachment of genetic modification technologies into Africa, and to reflect on the shared history of the individuals, organizations, and networks that came together to fight for food sovereignty and the rights of smallholder farmers over the past 20 years and longer. I am Sabrina Masinjila, a research and advocacy officer at the African Center for Biodiversity based in Tanzania. For 9 years, I've been part of ACB's passionate campaign against genetic modification in Africa. Now, I'm honored to host our first podcast, delving into our organization's journey and ongoing efforts. With me are Mariam Mayet, the executive director and founder of ACB, and we are also honored to be joined by Heidi Swanby, who was involved in the ACB in the early years. Welcome, Mariam.
Thank you very, very much, Sabrina, for the introduction and hosting this podcast. My name is Mariam Mayet. I am the director and founder of the African Center for Biodiversity. I have to mention that previously, our organization was called African Center for Biosafety to denote its principal focus more than 20 years ago on the issue of genetic modification of seed and crop plants in Africa. One must remember that the world was a very different place 20 years ago when very few people knew about genetic engineering, genetically modified organisms, Monsanto, the role of Gates Foundation, etc. We had to start a very difficult and pioneering journey towards not only awareness raising, but most importantly, to push against what we called the GM, genetic modification onslaught in Africa, and to get to grips with new discourses in regard to biosafety regulatory issues in particular. Heidi Swanby is one of the pioneer activists who, at that time when ACB was formed, was already working on the issue for many years with an organization called BioWatch. Later on, we were very honored to have Heidi join us as a staff member. And Heidi worked with us for more than a decade. And Heidi, on the one hand, we talk about genetically modified food crops and food products as representing a complex nexus of issues that include environmental and ecological concerns, health, socioeconomic impacts, corporate control over our knowledge systems, our food systems, its interface with climate change, and meriting a very important strategic response to, as we say, the corporate control over food systems, but also countering the myth perpetuated by the biotech industry that they were introducing a technology that would overcome global hunger and diet-related diseases and so on. But I want to start the discussion really to situate the GM debate within the context of the Green Revolution push in Africa. But I want to also, before doing that, introduce Heidi to this discussion, and maybe Heidi to remind you of the late Dr. Tawaldi's words. And he said at the time when we were negotiating the biosafety protocol, the Cartagena Protocol on biosafety, that there could hardly be a more effective form of colonialism, that the genetic engineering industry will effectively be able to hold us hostage. Heidi, what are your thoughts?
Hi, Mariam. Hi, Sabrina. I'm so happy to be with you this morning. Thanks so much for the invite and to just remember this incredible history that we've had together over the last two decades. So as you said, Miriam, I came into ACB having worked on some of these issues. And my background at that time had been working a lot with smallholder farmers across Africa. And in particular, I'd learned about permaculture and was just blown away that no one had ever taught me about ecology and the kind of intelligence of nature. And I was traveling all through Africa, spending time in farmers' fields, and just amazed at the knowledge and the diversity and the skill that I never knew about, especially coming from South Africa with its highly industrialized agricultural sector. So when I first learned of GMOs in the late 90s, I was just perplexed at something that seemed so violent and so so ignorant of ecology and of the agriculture systems that already existed. And I also had a quote from Tewolde that I thought I would like to bring in, and that was very much about the racism that he encountered in the international arena, bringing up some of the concerns around GMOs. And the way he put it was, said, the United States delegation noted that the strongest call for strict regulation of GMOs came from the African continent, which the delegation posited as an unjustified, ignorant fear from the most back continents about this avant-garde technology called modern biotechnology. So as you say, Miriam, it's a topic that encompasses so much and touches on so many issues and is way beyond just the science of this technology.
Thank you so much, Miriam and Heidi, for, you know, that introduction. So many personal stories and such an inspiring journey just to hear, you know, from the both of you, already bringing to the fore, you know, the root, the rich history, inspiring quotes from Dr. Tewolde. Just looking at this context, Miriam, in which you had already started painting, in which, you know, genetically modified crops were introduced, the details of how these technologies were seen as novel, the promises that were made by the industry at that time, which continue to be made even today, why we saw them as a potential threat, we still see them as a potential threat to our food and agricultural system, and why and how we began to resist this. I'll give it over to you, Miriam and Heidi.
Thank you so much. So I think that it's really important to understand how we as ACB, African Center for Biodiversity, Biosafety at the time, and our friends in the movement viewed the GM debate. And in the context of Africa, we felt that it was really important to understand that it was not something that was a new agricultural system, that it was very much situated within a particular model of agriculture, which is called the Green Revolution, although there is nothing green about it on the one hand, okay? And very importantly, the changes in the seed sector on the other, linked with mergers and acquisitions going on in the seed, biotech, pharmaceutical, agrochemical sector, as well as technological development. So these factors came together to present the overall context within which we had to navigate the GM onslaught in Africa. When we think about the Green Revolution model, we have to understand that it refers to monocrop production, which is a practice of growing a single crop year after year on the same land. So no diversity, no agricultural biodiversity there. It also refers to a technological package comprising of commercial, mainly corporate seed, including GM seed. So the GM seed became part of the commercial seed basket of the Green Revolution, together with the application of pesticides, inorganic fertilizers, irrigation, as well as a kind of closed value chain where the markets were controlled by agribusiness. So the seed markets, the agrochemical market, and the product. In the case of GM, we're talking really about maize, soya, and cotton. So we have to understand that GM seed was introduced to commercial farmers in South Africa and to regulators as a further step in seed breeding. And it was promoted as the next best thing in improved seed breeding that will cut down the use of pesticides as well as pesticide and pest management on farms. So honing in on the issue of corporate or commercial seed, we see this as the nexus to GMOs as two key issues. One relates to hybrid seed, and the next is in relation to intellectual property rights over seed. So just what I want to really say here is that one will not be able to really understand the incursion of genetically modified seed into agricultural systems unless one understands that it was part and parcel of the Green Revolution push, that it is linked with what was happening in the seed industry. It's linked with hybridization of seed and corporate control, and linked with intellectual property rights over seed. So I want to stop here and say, maybe Heidi, do you want to say something about these interlinkages and how we understood it at the time before I go into a deeper discussion on hybrids? Because from my perspective, I really think that the greatest threat to agricultural biodiversity and life on the planet in terms of food security in the future and even now is corporate control of a seed, particularly introduction of hybrid seed and what this has done to agricultural biodiversity, introduction of genetically modified seed, and then corporate control over our seed system, including over GM seed, and its impacts on farmers and agricultural biodiversity through intellectual property rights. So I want to stop there because maybe, Heidi, you want to say something about these interrelationships and how difficult it was also for us to explain to the public what was really going on behind the scenes and that it was not just a question of food safety or the question of choice and labeling.
Thanks, Miriam. What jumps into my mind is that we're talking about the late 90s in South Africa. So we'd just had our first democratic elections in 1994. And by 1999, our GMO Act was already being published. And I think what's important there for me is that South Africa already had a very industrialized food system or industrialized agricultural sector, and a very dualistic agricultural sector where commercial white farmers were using the land, the kind of 90% of the land that they gained through apartheid laws to produce the food. And that right at the beginning, so there was kind of an understanding that this is what agriculture looked like in South Africa, large-scale commercial with use of inputs and mechanization, cheap labor, actually maybe even wanting to get rid of labor as much as possible. And that right at that early time, we didn't have any knowledge about GMOs in civil society. And the corporate sector from that moment already took control of the narrative around GMOs, took control of drafting the laws and legislation, and also broadly just really shaped the trajectory of our agriculture and the values that underpin our agriculture. So and that corporate control has continued until today. So one, it was very difficult to dismantle that kind of idea of technological progress going into the new age of South Africa, and the idea that we have to feed people and how we do that. And on the other hand, it was also incredibly difficult to explain the actual science and technology to people and why it was different from conventional breeding and what risks it brought in terms of our health, our environment, our food system, and also politically. So yeah, it was a time of a lot of learning in amongst us in civil society and right across the continent, debating a lot about what exactly this new technology meant, how it was going to affect us over the long term, how it was going to affect farming systems. And then I think in South Africa, an even more complex set of discussions around what it meant for agrarian transformation and land distribution, what our food system looks like, who is able to participate in the food system. So those things we kind of learned as we were going along and learned through discussion and consultation and trial and error. And I think also we were doing a lot of learning about what the legislation did in reality. So the legislation was there, and I think ACB did a lot of pushing up against the legislation to see how it worked in reality and what rights it gave us.
Wow. Thank you so much, Mariam and Heidi, for, you know, just pointing out, you know, this key interlinkages. I think, Mariam, what you did mention with regards to the Green Revolution and how it offered that base to foist on the push for genetic modification and the push by the corporate sector, the corporatization of seed agriculture linked to intellectual property rights and all that. I think, Heidi, you've also touched on legislation, and we'll do in our next podcast a deep dive into, you know, what international legislation was there at the moment under the CBD. We refer to the Cartagena Protocol. So we'll have much more discussions on that. Maybe just back to you, Mariam, in terms of, you know, you spoke about this whole corporate control of seed and who were the key players at that time. We are, you know, when you look at the history, South Africa was one of, you know, the countries in Africa, the first country in Africa where GMOs were pushed upon, because it already has had this base for industrial agriculture and the corporates were highly dominated. So it was easier to, you know, make that introduction of GMOs in South Africa. So maybe, Mariam, can you speak about a bit about this whole corporatization of the food system and how that also affected the rest of the African countries and push for the introduction of GMOs onto the rest of the country of the African continent?
Just to pick up, as you say, Sabrina, regarding the link with Green Revolution. So going back to GM seeds, and just to reiterate that they are designed to be used in large-scale industrial farming systems, okay, involving big commercial farmers that have access or at their disposal vast land areas, expensive machinery like tractors, combine harvesters, irrigation infrastructure, resources to purchase fertilizers, inorganic fertilizers, pesticides, herbicides in particular, and generally access to credit and good markets. So very much unlike small-scale farming systems and farmer seeds, GM seeds are bred in conjunction with the breeding of commercial seed, whether it's industrial hybrid seed or even open pollinated varieties. They are all commercial, industrial level seed bred by developers of either GM products or the big seed companies that I'll come to in a minute. But the important thing about both GM and hybrid seed is that they perform only well in one growing season and that the seed has to be bought every year. So this is really important. And I think that it's important for us to note that one of the reasons why the leading biotech company, Monsanto, which is now Bayer Monsanto, was able to become so powerful is because it was able to patent traits used in the development of GM seeds. And this is why I said that the link with Green Revolution, seed issues, control over seed, and then intellectual property rights and technology. So the patenting of GM traits gave Monsanto in particular enormous amount of control over farmers and the breeding sector. And for example, they also made farmers sign contracts agreeing not to replant seed or share seed. In any case, plant variety protection legislation, which is a part of intellectual property rights, prohibits farmers from saving seed from the previous harvest for further propagation. So Monsanto's ownership rights can also stop other breeders from using the technology. So instead of others wanting to use Monsanto's technology, or if they want to use Monsanto's technology, they have to enter into licensing agreements and pay Monsanto royalties to use the trait. So just to understand that component of corporate control. But I think that maybe, Sabrina, if you don't mind, if I could just quickly introduce what genetic engineering, what GMOs are, and then Heidi and I can jointly discuss the corporate control issues. So I think that it's important to appreciate that since farming began, people have worked with nature to breed plants and animals to suit human needs. Usually this breeding can only happen within the same species or family. Now, in terms of genetic modification or genetic engineering, creating GMOs, what happened was scientists, particularly in the molecular biology field, began to use genetic modification or transgenic techniques to create plants. But the focus was on seeds, okay? was to create new kind of new plants that would display novel characteristics that would not naturally occur in nature. This is really important. So what they did is they began to look for specific characteristics called traits in nature that they could extract and then insert into an unrelated organism. So they would then force the DNA from one organism, an unrelated organism, into another that would never occur in nature. This is a completely unnatural form of breeding regarding not only about forcing DNA from one to the other, but crossing the species boundary and even crossing species in plant and animal kingdoms. So, and then you get the resulting organism called a GMO. So genetic engineering uses transgenic techniques to create GMOs, okay? Genetically modified organisms using either hybrid or open pollinated seeds. The big difference from an intellectual property perspective is that with GM seed, the genetic construct or the uniquely designed DNA is given patent protection because the breeder or developer can argue that they have created something new. At the same time, the developer has been saying to regulators, GMOs are nothing new. They are substantially equivalent to their conventional counterpart and need no regulation, that they introduce no new risks, and that they should be introduced into our food system without regulation. So I think this is an important point because this is where a lot of the contention arose around biosafety regulation of GMOs. So we have to understand that a GMO involves the integration of novel foreign DNA into the plant genome. The uniquely designed DNA then can also be protected by utility patents. Second, utility patents provide better protection against infringement. So what this means is that it prohibits other individuals or companies from making, using, or selling the invention without paying royalties. So there's many layers of protection for the breeders. Hybrid seed and plant variety protection are also sometimes referred to as plant breeders' rights and patent protection. So Haiti, this is about the corporate control over seed. And we will remember that at the time when GMOs were introduced into the food systems in South Africa in particular, the global seed market was undergoing major changes and it was becoming highly concentrated with just a few multinational companies led by Monsanto, DuPont, and Syngenta controlling the seed, the commercial seed market, and they then in turn controlled the GM seed market. And of course, today we know that Monsanto has merged with Bayer Crop Science, DuPont merged with Dow AgroSciences, and Syngenta acquired ChemChina, and now we only have three, but we used to have six. But just to say that the multinational capture of local seed companies got underway first in South Africa, a country, as we know, that was already very far down the path of green revolution agriculture. And we will remember, Heidi, that in the late 1999, just as we were coming out of the euphoria of our new democracy, Monsanto purchased two of South Africa's largest seed companies, Kania and Sensaco. And then in 2012, decades or so later, the last remaining maize company, Panna Seed, was taken over by the US firm Pioneer Hybrid, itself a subsidiary of DuPont, and ACB participated in a big and protected litigation where we opposed the merger. And after that, there was increasing mergers and acquisitions taking place also on the rest of the continent regarding particularly the cotton seed market by Monsanto. So, Heidi, do you want to say anything from your perspective about this particular development and its significance in terms of aiding the introduction and uptake of GM seed, particularly in South Africa? And here, I want to just remind us that not everything is genetically modified on the market. At the moment, it's only maize, soybean, and cotton. But I wanted to ask Heidi to tell us about the experience, particularly around the uptake of genetically modified cotton in South Africa and the experience of the Makatini flat farmers, small-scale farmers who were severely impacted, and the extent to which Monsanto used that experience to push GMOs as a solution to hunger on the continent.
So we've heard a lot about the fact that GMOs are part of this kind of green revolution technology. And a lot of the critique that was coming out that the biotech companies were having to deal with at that time was that this was a technology made for large-scale commercial agriculture, and it was wholly inappropriate for smallholder African farmers. And of course, there was also quite a lot of international debate regarding the safety of eating GMOs. So cotton has always been a target crop for those who are trying to promote GMOs, just because it's a cash crop. It's a crop where a lot of pesticides are already used. So the argument was that GMOs would reduce the use of pesticides and exposure to pesticides. It would boost incomes. Didn't have to worry about safety issues because we weren't going to eat it, although cotton does come into our food chain through oil. And so the idea that Monsanto had was to go to the Makatini Flats in KwaZulu-Natal and set up a flagship project where they would prove to the world that GMOs were indeed appropriate for smallholder farmers. And what they did was kind of handpick farmers in the area and cultivate their farms for them in a way. And then have these wonderful GMO crops and host kind of seeing is believing tours with the media and with policymakers from all around Africa and all around the world. And these farmers would show off their wonderful GMO crops. And we saw this again, repeated again in Burkina Faso, many years later. But tragically, what happened in Makatini is that when people did adopt the technology without all of the support from Monsanto and all of their, you know, they wanted to have these perfect PR farms that they could bring people to see. But once just normal smallholders started adopting the technology, they really struggled. Firstly, because it requires a huge amount of financial support. So people had to take out loans. Also, they're doing it on a very small scale. It means you have to access markets and be able to recoup the costs. And if I remember correctly, there was three terrible seasons. I can't remember it. It was a drought and then 2 years of flood, or the other way around. And farmers just really struggled to recoup any kind of profits from their crops. So just in unbelievable, terrible debt. And I was working in that area at the time and just speaking to farmers who were having experiences with the crop. The adoption of GMO cotton in the Makatini flats caused real devastation on real lives of people who lost a lot of their money, lost their land, lost their cattle, often lost social relationships because others in the family may have committed their pensions or given loans. And eventually the local loan institutions just collapsed under the weight of all this unpaid debt. And it really ended up showcasing just how devastating this technology is for smallholder farmers once they give up their autonomy and their own decision-making power and buy into this incredibly high-end technology. Very expensive, needs a lot of care and a lot of inputs in order to succeed, and then also needs a lot of other kinds of power. I mean, these farmers ended up being price takers, so they would pour their money into the crop and then at the end not get good prices. What we really learned is how much smallholders spread their risk, you know, how much they put into making sure that their margins of risk are narrowed, that they have diverse crops, that they have diverse manners of income. You still see articles from the early 2000s from biotech companies about the amazing success of Makatini flats, and then you never see the later articles where the whole thing just collapsed completely. And today, smallholder farmers in South Africa don't grow GM cotton at all. It's the domain of large-scale commercial farmers. Although in South Africa, cotton is not a big cash crop. It's kind of planted in between the major cash crops. But if anything, the Makatini experience did the exact opposite of what Monsanto was hoping to prove, and showed the true devastation that the technology brought to the people of that region, who were kind of tricked into adopting this technology for the sake of Monsanto's PR campaign.
Following from that, I think the experience of the Makatini flats does really show how the many promises by the industry on genetic modification under this whole green revolution agenda and the push for industrial agriculture have failed, I think, and continue to fail to address, you know, the challenges in the agricultural sector, but also fail to address the real structural and the systemic issues faced by many countries. And Heidi, you do paint that picture that you know, the many promises that, you know, were put forward by the industry, to date, we haven't really seen, you know, those coming to fruition. The promises that are put forward by the corporates, at the end of the day, aim only to boost their profit making and to continue expanding their reach onto the continent. I think it would be good to maybe just give a few examples of what the major promises or claims for genetic modification that were made by the industry at that time, and you know, and continue to be made even today. We see, for example, the continued push for insect-resistant crops, herbicide-tolerant crops, the use of glyphosate, as associated chemicals such as glyphosate, and even other traits that, you know, do not work, such as drought-tolerant crops. We did maybe briefly talk about, you know, the push for GMOs into this whole, you know, by this whole Green Revolution agenda, the influence of the corporates, the patenting of traits for profit making, but also what were, you know, the many claims that the industry fought to say you need GMOs in your country. They'll, you know, for example, in the case of Makatini, they'll reduce poverty, and you know, the many other promises. Can you briefly just highlight what of the were these major promises and the failures that we've come to see today on this genetically modified crops?
Thank you, Sabrina. So picking up also from this Makatini example, regarding the value to the industry of the PR generated around, I won't say accessibility, but the fact that this technology is suitable and appropriate for smallholder farmers. One also has to link this up with the, I won't say just geopolitics happening at the time, but there was several other factors at play regarding the fights between the US and the EU at the time, because when we began to work on the issue in 1999, in the US, many millions of hectares of GMOs were being grown already and had been deregulated. The EU was very, very reluctant and opposed to this technology, and consumer campaigns were awash in the EU. The role of the US government in pushing this technology on the continent and in South Africa via the Makatini Flats example cannot be underestimated. In the case of the Makatini Flats, the PR generated by Monsanto that these farmers were becoming wealthy, that they were able to afford cars, tractors, was essential to both the US government's interest in promoting GM, because they needed to ensure the markets were open for the sale of GM seed and related products in the world, and to showcase a success story that African smallholder impoverished farmers became wealthy as a result of growing GM crops. This was essential. And they then showcased this internationally. They also took these small-scale farmers from Makatini Flats to the US, to Washington, and around the world, actually. The story was spread about the success of the cotton in Makatini Flats in South Africa. It was a pivotal part of the PR exercise to promote GMOs. And part of the hype of both the US government and the industry, spearheaded by Monsanto, was that it would reduce and combat hunger in Africa. This was the argument to win on their part was that it would eradicate hunger. It was and they consistently tried to win this fight. To commercial big farmers, a different story was told. They were told that the genetic modification would involve an insect-resistant trait, and that this will reduce pesticide use and pesticide management. The crop plant will produce its own insecticide, and this will in turn mean that farmers will not need to spray additional pesticides. But then also that the crop plant will be genetically engineered to tolerate the spraying of herbicides, and that farmers will not need to employ so many laborers to weed, and that the spraying of herbicide, in particular glyphosate, at the time was still under patent by Monsanto, will, on the part of commercial farmers, reduce labor costs. And this was very attractive to large-scale commercial farmers. But on the rest of the continent, where small-scale farmers predominate, they needed to win the argument that first, it was a technology that was suitable for small-scale farming. Second, that it would enhance the quality of lives of farmers, and that it will play a major role in combating hunger. So this was the major promises made at the time. I think that it's also important to note that they pushed very strongly against regulation. And we can talk about some of the regulatory concerns that we had. But Heidi, do you want to add anything more onto the hype and the promises made by the industry at the time to both small-scale farmers and to commercial farmers? The one thing I have to say is that they were not able to, at that time, convince regulators on the rest of the continent. At that time, South Africa did not stand with the rest of the continent in the African group of negotiators, because parallel to this GM push in Africa was the negotiations internationally for a legally binding international agreement to regulate this technology, because there was a fear that if we did not have an international agreement, that parties to the Convention on Biological Diversity, an international agreement to protect biodiversity, agreed to and that would implement at the national level, we would be in a situation of a free-for-all and an unregulated technology deployed on the continent and the global south in particular, completely unregulated.
Yeah, I think that's a very important point that you make, Miriam, especially in light of what you were saying earlier about the fact that there was a fight about this technology between the US and the EU, and some of that fight was kind of fought out on the African continent. For example, Makatini PR stunt, because a narrative formed then and persists until today that that any pushback or any caution around GMOs on the African continent comes from the EU, and that civil society in Africa are just kind of our strings are being pulled from Europe, and that actually this is a technology that's desired in Africa and needed in Africa. And I think it's really important that you point how strong the African position was and African leadership against GMOs, and how clearly formulated this was by African leadership with support from African civil society about the dangers that GMOs would bring to African agricultural systems, to our biodiversity, our agrobiodiversity, to our livelihoods, our autonomy, our food sovereignty and food security. So it was definitely an African campaign born of African concerns, and not something that came through our donors from the EU. And then the other thing I think as well about the all of the promises that were being made is that I think at that time the science was very new in molecular biology. There was a lot of excitement. I think, I can't remember if it was in the mid-80s that the human genome was finally mapped, and a lot of surprises were coming through the science around what scientists thought genes could do and what they actually, how they actually turned out once the science was growing. And so at the time when they still thought that kind of one gene equaled one trait, and they thought the genes were kind of building blocks, very linear, they were promising the world with GM technologies that we would see improved nutrition, we'd see drought tolerance, saline tolerance. I mean, just the list was endless of what this technology was going to do for humanity and just end world hunger. And as they got more deeply into trying to produce working products that could come onto the market, they realized actually how complex genes are and how much unknowns they are. So in the end, we got these very simplistic GMOs after 3 decades that, you know, mostly herbicide tolerance or the production of pesticides from the plant are the two major traits which ended up being doable. But really, I think that it's still this branch of science is still very nascent, and there's still massive unknowns and around the complexity of how genes work, and that's why a lot of the promises haven't been fulfilled, and we just have these really basic technologies 30 years later. An issue that that has been problematic since the very beginning of this debate has been how the biotech industry wants to have their cake and eat it, in terms of insisting that we must have science-based decision-making in our legal systems. And this is kind of a way of making sure that issues outside of their purview and outside of their control, like ethics or wider political power within the system, doesn't come into decision-making. So while they say that everything must be science-based, when we come to our decision-making, there's no science. Well, there's very little science or proper rigorous science there. The decisions are made based on safety data provided by the proponents of GMOs, very often not available in its entirety to the public, redacted, protected by confidential business information, which is not scientific, because science should be available to the public, should be peer-reviewed, should be up for debate. The anti-GMO lobby is always called unscientific, based on junk science. But when you really dig deeply into it, what the anti-GMO lobby has been calling for is more science, not less. Miriam touched on the notion of substantial equivalence, which is profoundly unscientific right from the beginning. They said, it's nothing new, so it doesn't have to be regulated, but it's also so novel that we can patent it. Or the biotech industry might say, Americans have been eating GMOs for 20 years, or South Africans have been eating GMOs for 20 years, and there's never been an incident, which is also profoundly unscientific. There's never been a study done. There's no data to back up that statement. So like a big frustration has always been this double standards of saying everything must be science-based, and yet there's absolutely no science in our real decision-making procedures.
So I think it's really important also to understand that not everything on the supermarket shelves are GMOs. For example, in South Africa, where GM crop plants have been growing for more than 25 years, we in civil society have confined it only to GM maize, soya, and cotton because of the activism over the last 20 years. We have successfully kept GM potatoes, cassava, banana, sorghum off the supermarket shelves. And we've also restricted the varieties of maize, soya, and cotton that could come onto the market. Wheat was one of the first GM crop plants that we campaigned against 20 years ago. And it's now come back 20 years later to bite us again. But the players are completely different, and we will pick up the issue of GM wheat another time. But it has not been approved in South Africa for commercial cultivation, only for import to be used as food, feed, and processing. But to date, no GM wheat has been imported into South Africa. So we really only have these three categories.
Thank you so much, Mariam and Heidi, for just giving us that picture about, the promises by the industry and the failures of GM. And there are so many examples. I think the Makatini floods should have been an opener, an eye opener for, all these failures. But later we see the continued adoption of, the same failed technologies across the continent.
I think that because of the bigger power place between multinational companies, between the US at the time and the EU, of course, geopolitically so much has changed. But at that time, there was a trade war going on between the EU and the US. We were tarred with the same brush as they tarred the EU, the US, and Monsanto and the biotech machinery. They propagated the myth or disinformation that activists in South Africa and the continent were funded by the organic movement in the EU. They could not accept that we could campaign independently, that we would have our own agency, and that we genuinely were opposed to this technology, and that we were also named as Luddites, anti-technology, that we wanted to keep farmers in destitution, and that we were standing in the way of progress. I think this is an important overarching issue to understand. And the last point I want to make is how difficult it was for us to have pushed back against this technology, because it was in the realm of molecular biology. Then also having this disinformation campaigns by the biotech industry, the closed door on the part of the South African government, and then there were no GMOs growing on the rest of the continent, but we wanted to stave it off. So we had a lot of obstacles in our path, but we were actually very successful over the 25 years, and there were many, many successes on our part, and then there were also many, many failures on the part of the biotech industry, and we hope that we will be able to go through these in the podcast to follow. But I want to just end here to acknowledge many, many people and many, many organizations that played a very, very important role in pushing back against this technology. Back home here in South Africa, there were many, many organizations and individuals behind these organizations that played a pivotal role and with whom ACB partnered. And here I would like to acknowledge EarthLife Africa, the South African Freeze Alliance on Genetic Engineering, SafeAge, and BioWatch, and the general public who supported our campaigns. I think it was really an uphill battle, but we together worked to push for very stringent biosafety regulation. We launched objections to genetic modification GM applications. We interrogated these applications. We launched campaigns for labeling. We did testing. We did a huge amount of work together, and I would just like to acknowledge this cumulative contribution.
Wow, thank you so much. It has been really great hosting this podcast. I think this conversation has really traced back, you know, from the introduction of GMOs in South Africa, aided by the Green Revolution agenda, the corporate control in South Africa and the rest of the continent, the promises of the promises and the PR machinery behind the push for GM on the continent, the failures of these promises. And what has really struck me is, you know, the continued resistance by civil society movements, even despite the challenges and that they have faced. I think, Heidi, you've really highlighted some of the challenges faced by civil society organizations with the science, but also, Mariam, with regards to, you know, all this, you know, the how the industry has viewed civil society organizations in, you know, while we challenge, you know, the push for, you know, this push on GMOs on the continent. I think, you know, despite all these challenges, there's quite a lot of resilience by these groups and ACB who continue to challenge these technologies. And as Mariam has mentioned, we will take a deep dive onto some of these discussions, including, you know, some of these GM failures, the key campaigns done by African civil society organizations and ACB, including ACB, on key crops, and the fights to have GMOs regulated. But when it comes to, you know, discussion around, you know, our engagement in the international arena, the drafting of the Cartagena Protocol, as we have briefly touched on, but we'll have more discussions on this as we continue to look back on our legacy of two decades of activism. So thank you so much, and we look forward to having you in our next podcast.